Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
You know, that Spurs game plan, that's what they're trying to achieve. They're trying to achieve those good chances breaking into space. If you just get a free kick in your own half, the opposition have 11 men behind the ball.
And you think, well, he's not going to get the other yellow card, so he's fine to just have that one as a free hit.
Hi there, welcome. This is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. We are a weekly show brought to you by The Athletic and dedicated to topics including, but certainly not limited to, football tactics, data analysis of the beautiful game and footballing trends as well. Delighted to be back this week, and a big thanks to those of you who sent kind words about last week's episode. Glad you enjoyed it. It's always good to hear from you. Helps us to learn more, really, about what you guys like to listen to. I'm Ali Maxwell. Michael Cox is here too. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Ali.
How are you?
I'm good. Looking forward to this podcast. Been a good couple of first weekends of the Premier League, so looking forward to getting stuck into it.
Quite right. Mark Carey rejoins us. Good to have you back, Mark. All well?
Yeah, all well, thanks. Yeah, I was going to say I very much enjoyed the podcast last week with you guys and John Muller. It was fun to be a listener again. It was like the good old days. Now that I'm on the podcast, I don't normally listen back to it quite as much. So it was just like being a good old listener.
It's 2 weeks in a row where one of you has missed the pod and then come on and said how much better you thought the pod was without. Yeah. If anything, I'd like a bit more ego. I'd like a bit more arrogance.
But you can give it a go if you want, Ali. See if it works for you.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Fair. I cannot tell you how much I would hate listening back to this podcast without me presenting it. I would feel so jealous. Anyway, we are 2 weeks into the Premier League season, and this episode will be filled with observations on early trends, new dynamics, and a few quirks as well. I'm going to ask the guys about the impact of referees letting the game go with their much-discussed higher threshold. I also want to check in with early signs from the increased number of substitutions allowed in the Premier League, moving in line with other top European leagues from 3 subs to 5 subs this season. But let's start with something tactical. 3 at the back. Michael, last season, whenever we spoke about 3 at the back systems, we kind of bemoaned the fact that it felt like you always have to say Team X playing a 3 at the back, or a 5, if you prefer. But it feels like 3 has kind of won out here, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, to be honest, it's probably part of that is because I think there's more teams these days that play with an attacking intent. There were times where it did feel like a back five. I think there's still probably a couple. I think the way Bournemouth have played it, I think naturally because they played against Manchester City, that did feel like a back five to me. But yeah, in general, I think you look at the identity of the players out wide and they're generally players who can push forward and overlap. And it's not just putting an extra centre back in, which in days gone by, I mean, probably a long time in the past, 20, 25 years ago, it did feel like teams just added an extra centre back without really adjusting how they played overall. But yeah, some people will kind of see a third centre back as a negative move, but I don't think that's always the case.
No, well, we're going to have a look at its usage in the Premier League so far. 3ATB, as it's often used in shorthand. Tactical systems using 3 centre backs and within that, many different ways to execute it. A steady increase, Mark, really over the last 2 or 3 seasons. And it feels like even more so this season, we've leapt up at another level in terms of 3 at the back systems in the Premier League, with the acceptance of this being a very small sample size.
Took the words out of my mouth. I was going to start by saying small sample size. I caveat everything that I say. So true to form. But yeah, I did look into the numbers, and of the 40 starting lineups that we've had across the 2 game weeks, 18 have started with a back 3/5. Let's call it a back 3 for the consistency. So if you were to be, you know, simplistic about that, that's 45% of the sides in the opening 2 weeks, which feels quite high. And as Michael mentioned, you know, we've got two of the three teams of the who come up from the Championship who have been playing with that sort of system. Obviously, Bournemouth moved to a back three, back five, from playing predominantly the back four last season, which we've discussed on this podcast, actually. But yeah, I think it is an interesting one how, you know, you can think of it as a back five. Crystal Palace being another example from Monday, they were definitely more of a back five. But yeah, it seems that almost half of the teams so far seem to be playing with that system, which is really interesting.
And I think you can actually go further because there's a couple of teams who have played a back four on paper and a back four without the ball, but of course shift into back three. I mean, Arsenal have very noticeably done that with Zinchenko being almost like an extra central midfielder in possession. And I'd say Manchester City at the weekend as well were doing something similar. I wouldn't classify those, strictly speaking, as a back three. But clearly there is some kind of hybrid systems in play as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I mean, looking at last season, comparing that number that I mentioned to last season, I took it to just the first two game weeks just to see if there's any early signs rather than comparing it across the whole season. So it was 9 of the 40 starting lineups who started with a back 3-5 at this stage last season. That's low as 23%, so significantly low. So we've got essentially double the number of sides starting with that sort of system in the early parts of this season. And across the whole of the season last year, it was 29%. So nearly a third of sides across the whole season having that sort of back 3-5 system. So to start with as high as 45%, again, ludicrously small sample size, but it does seem to be rather high and certainly worthy of comment in our little notebook.
One of the fixtures in which we've seen two teams playing on paper 3-ATB systems was on the weekend, Chelsea against Spurs. Michael, you wrote a really good tactical takeaways piece from this one. And in that piece, particularly certain managers, and dare I say at the very top managers, are just doing so, they're just so active tactically within that framework, both in and out of possession, that one shouldn't pigeonhole them. This game, really interesting tactically. One player you highlighted in particular was the role of Mason Mount, who seems so often used by Thomas Tuchel as basically the key tactical piece or differential in this Chelsea side.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I think Mount's a very interesting player because obviously there's a generation of very talented young attacking midfielders, English attacking midfielders. You can put him in a group, I guess, with Foden and Grealish and Saka. And I must say, of all of those, in terms of what he contributes on the ball, I'm not sure Mount really stands out. But I think the way that he excels is he's very, very intelligent. He's really good at finding space. The first time I saw him play was Frank Lampard's first game as Chelsea manager when they lost 4-0 away at Old Trafford. But I actually thought Mount was the best player because he's so good at finding space. And in this game, I think he was the key player. And it was almost, I mean, for all the kind of tactical complexities in a game between Conte and Tuchel, it felt really to me just like a clash of formations. It was basically that Spurs were playing 3-4-3 and Chelsea were playing more of a 3-5-2. Certainly in terms of how the midfield shaped up. And it just meant that when, you know, the two Spurs central midfielders pressed their opposite numbers, Mount was just free between the lines. And the player who was coming up to close them down was Romero, the Spurs centre-back. And obviously that was him coming 20, 30 yards out of his defence. So I thought that was the key feature of the game. I think Chelsea kind of let themselves down because they lacked good passing quality. You know, I said in the article, I think it was quite indicative of Chelsea under Tuchel since he took charge. Tactically, they're really, really good. Very rare you see them kind of tactically outplayed or outplayed in general. But they just don't convert their superiority in certain positions into chances and goals. And I think whether that's because of individuals or whether it's something slightly flawed in the way Tuchel wants to play, but we've seen Chelsea have a lot of very good individuals who just haven't clicked. They just, it's very rare to find a Chelsea attacker over the last couple of years who's enjoyed a sustained run of form. Obviously, Werner's been tried and has left. Lukaku's been tried and has left. Ziyech, Pulisic, none of these players really are playing as well as they have done at their previous clubs. And the more that happens, the more you think there's some kind of pattern there.
I was going to ask if there was, in your eyes, an obvious solution to Chelsea's issues of not being deadly enough inside the box. Is it to do with the number nine? It's so often that's what gets focused on. Does that obscure other issues? You talked about passing quality there.
The other player who I think has done well, broadly speaking, is Kai Havertz since he joined the club. And I think he's actually a kind of similar player to Mount in that he's really, really good at finding space. His end product sometimes is a bit lacking. And I mean, that you know, he missed an absolutely golden chance in this game, which sums it up. Made the right run, understood the situation, just didn't put the ball in the goal. We know that Chelsea is still in the market for another attacker. The identity and the style of that attacker seems quite fluid. I mean, Anthony Gordon...
One man's fluid is another man's incredibly random.
Yeah, I mean, Gordon looks a really talented player. But I'm not sure he's necessary. He's not really the kind of player Chelsea lack. I mean, they've already signed Sterling, who is a kind of mobile winger who can play through the middle, running the channels, going in behind. So clearly they want that sort of player rather than a kind of fixed number nine. But yeah, I find the situation with Chelsea's attackers a little bit strange.
Yeah, I mean, it was the point exactly I was going to make on that. And I was speaking to Liam Toomey, our Chelsea writer, and he essentially said as much, said that you don't get the sense that Tuchel is looking for a fixed number nine, you know, in the mould of Lukaku per se. I mean, it just didn't work out, did it, last season for reasons off the pitch as much as on it. But you want, you know, maybe looking for a clinical finisher, but not necessarily a fixed number nine. And that's why, again, in the mould of random shouts, you know, Aubameyang being a name that's been touted, he actually would fit the mould of someone who actually played, you know, a lot of his best football, not necessarily as the number nine, but playing, obviously coming in for the left-hand side. So a clinical finisher, not necessarily a number nine, is maybe who they're looking for.
In the second half, after Chelsea had been comfortably the better side in the first, Conte did make a tactical tweak, Michael, from 3-5-2 to 4-2-4, really. Is this typical of Conte, and how did it impact the game?
Kind of. Well, it's very typical of Conte going back 10 years, because before he joined Juventus, and in fact in his first half season at Juventus, he did favour this system, which was, I think most people would say 4-2-4, but in Italy they're quite bold and say 4-2-4 if you're using proper wingers rather than kind of workman-like midfielders. And it did work, although I thought, I mean, Tottenham took more control of the game, and of course they created a couple of very good chances. I think the main chance from Kane, which he missed, was actually a bit of an anomaly just because Loftus-Cheek from wing-back had pushed forward a lot. But it did help. I mean, he was an extra attacking player, and I think Richarlison is very good with his work off the ball as well. Chelsea got a goal from a long-range strike, but I think Tuchel actually made quite a good change in terms of he brought on Azpilicueta for Jorginho, which meant that Loftus-Cheek went into the middle. Azpilicueta went right side of centre-back, and then suddenly Reece James was on the right, and Loftus-Cheek played all right. I think he carried the ball well in field, well in the first half. But it was almost like you had the classic situation now of a wing-back against a back four. And twice, James just got space on the outside, first to cross for that Havertz chance, and then obviously to score and put Chelsea 2-1 ahead. And I thought that would kind of be a fitting way for the game to end. I just think Tuchel got the better of the tactical battle, both from the start and with his changes. Obviously, then Chelsea couldn't defend a late set piece. But overall, I came out of the game thinking Chelsea played pretty well. And yeah, just the better side on the day.
Well, if the positive for Spurs was their mentality and keeping pressure on until the end, if not winning the tactical battle, do you think Spurs and Conte may need to become less predictable tactically? I think the way that they play from the start in each game feels relatively predictable, and that's not necessarily a huge issue if plan A is good enough, but does his changes in game need to be a little less predictable as well to stop the likes of Tuchel outsmarting him, as you suggested that he did?
I mean, I do think of Conte as a real tactician, someone who can use different systems, but he has been relatively wedded to this way of playing. I mean, I think you can make an argument either way. I mean, Liverpool have been pretty consistent the last few years in terms of how they've set up. And I know they've only won one title, which maybe they could have won more, but I don't think that's been a particular issue for them. And I do think that Conte has the alternatives up his sleeve when required. He can go to 3-5-2. He can go to 4 at the back. So I think there are enough tactical options. I think to come back to your first question, Ali, I think the difficult thing with playing Chelsea is Mount can play in a front three, or he can play as part of the midfield. And at times he's kind of doing both. So they've got that real fluidity between systems. I'm not sure Spurs can do that. I mean, Kulusevski can play deeper, but probably not really as a central midfielder. So I guess when you see the 11 on paper, you do pretty much know what system it's going to be. Whereas I think Chelsea, with some of their versatile players, I mean, when their team sheet came out, I wasn't sure if that was maybe a back four. It could have been Reece James at right back with Loftus-Cheek as a midfielder. So maybe just the versatility of Chelsea's players gives them a bit of an edge, I suppose.
Something you said about Mount is really interesting to me, and I wonder if it could be worth a more extended part of an episode or an episode of its own. And that was comparing him to the other players, let's say, who occupy similar areas of the pitch. I know that we're trying to be a bit more fluid with our roles here, our role definition, but the likes of Foden and Grealish. And, you know, you mentioned Mount's possibly his greatest value being a tactical one and the fluidity that he offers managers and, dare I say it, out of possession and his work rate, his ability to press and how well he's done that over the last few seasons. And clearly, or perhaps not clearly, but probably less of an on-ball value compared to some of those players. And it'd be interesting to discuss that in a bit more detail and kind of weigh up what one is after when building a team. On-ball value versus out-of-possession value versus a tactical value that's obviously very hard to measure. Mark, it'd be an interesting one, that.
Yeah, and this is why it's the notorious sort of issue or question in the data from looking at it, because often we deal with event data, and by definition, you have to have an event for that to be logged in the player's value and their contribution. You can go into greater depth, and we've spoken about things like possession value and looking at it beyond just looking at, you know, shots and goals and things like that. But all of those off-ball things are so difficult to quantify in the data, in the numbers. And that's why you still can't replace things like video and real-life scouting and real-life tactical analysis, because the value, as we know, that the likes of Mason Mount offers are things that do go far beyond the data. So tricky one to quantify, but definitely from a tactical perspective, something to dig into, yeah.
Back to three at the back systems in general. Michael, a few questions about this. They may be a bit general, but I'm going to throw them your way anyway and see what you think. There's been a lot of talk about the importance of pressing, increased importance of pressing over the last 5 years rather than the last one or two. Is it harder to press effectively when you are playing with three centre-backs in a three centre-back system, given that that generally means, or it has to mean, at least one fewer attacker or midfielder who would ordinarily be pressing at the top of the pitch?
I think it depends really on the shape you're playing against. I don't think so in general. I think you can find examples of teams where they play with three centre-backs and pretty much everyone else is pressing high up the pitch. And I know it didn't really work particularly well, but even in this game, Spurs did show that you can push a centre-back forward and Romero into the midfield to close down if needed, if you got the right kind of centre-back. And it didn't really cost them as much as it might have done. So yeah, to a certain extent, but I think it depends on the shapes, really.
I guess you need very good awareness defensively from the other players, let's say the right wing-back or the other centre-backs when Romero is pushing high into midfield to make sure that any gaps get filled. On the other side of things, is it harder to press effectively against a team playing with three centre-backs because they have, in theory anyway, more numbers to build from deep?
I'd say, again, it depends on the shapes. But I think probably there's more of an argument for this. I think you have got an extra centre-back there. You have got an extra player in build-up. It generally does force opponents to commit another player higher up the pitch. So I think there's probably more of an argument for this. But I mean, yeah, it depends on the shape, doesn't it? I mean, if there's a 3-4-3 against a 3-4-3, which I think is kind of what Tottenham are expecting, then everyone knows who they've got to press. Mm. It's you're basically matching up the systems there. I think it depends.
It's like asking me what my favourite pasta is. It just depends on the shapes. You just can't. There's no definitive answer. It all depends on the shapes and the sauce. Mark, three at the back means wing-backs. So far, at least, I'm looking forward to a team playing three at the back and just ignoring the wide areas altogether, but it hasn't really happened yet. They come in all different shapes and sizes, modern wing-backs. I'd like to know which unusual players have been playing wing-back in the Premier League in the first 2 weeks of the season. So not your ordinary standard wing-back type.
Yeah, I mean, the one that stand out to me the most from the first round of fixtures is the use of inverted wing-backs from Brighton against Manchester United. I thought it was so well done, such a, you know, an ingenious move from Graham Potter. And they have done it before. They had Leandro Trossard as a right-footed left wing-back and Solly March as a left-footed right wing-back, which I'm taking my time in saying that because it's a bit of a mouthful. But it caused, as I say, it caused Manchester United problems throughout the game. And I think that's how the goal came about, the first goal, and it was allowing them to sort of come inside and play more kind of slide rule passes, more of through balls rather than what we would consider to be typical wing back play, which is obviously getting it wide, high and wide, and getting crosses in. So it allowed them to obviously invert the pitch and come inside more, which played into Brighton's hands perfectly, and Manchester United just didn't have an answer for it. So that was a really good, intelligent use of wing back play that was slightly different to normal.
We saw Loftus-Cheek at right wing back for Chelsea at parts on the weekend against Spurs. Gineppo of Saints sprang to mind when I was just having a quick look this morning, playing left wing back for the first two games for Southampton. Not necessarily the obvious role for him, from what I know about Gineppo anyway. So interesting stuff from Hasenhüttl. We move on though. This is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. Next, we're talking about five subs and increased thresholds for physical contact. And it's as sexy as it sounds. Stay with us.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Hello, I'm Ian Irving, host of the Athletic's Manchester United podcast, Talk of the Devils. Join me, Andy Mitten, Laurie Whitwell and Carl Anker every week, but particularly this week, as we gear up to the huge Liverpool game at Old Trafford on Monday night. We'll preview that match, without paying any reference to our meeting with our rivals from last season, of course, and we'll also assess the latest twists and turns in Manchester United's rollercoaster of a summer transfer window. You won't get better insight on United anywhere else, and as you'll find, you won't get better cocktails chat either. Just search for Talk of the Devils wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's get into five substitutions. Lots of talk about this ahead of the new season, the Premier League finally following suit with the rest of Europe. Michael, from the very foundation of five subs during COVID times, I think it's fair to say you were never a fan of this idea and its adoption from the start. How do you feel about it now?
Yeah, I'm still not a massive fan. I don't particularly see that there's many real benefits for football here. I'd say there's four areas I would say is a bit of a concern, and I'm going to leave aside for now the argument about whether it suits bigger teams or not, because I think there's been a lot of discussion about that. But one, I think it increases the tempo of games, which I don't think in itself is necessarily a good thing. I think the games are played at a good tempo at the moment, and I think there is a danger that there'll be just so much focus and so much emphasis on pressing and aggression and getting really tight that actually some of the more cultured players who thrive with a bit of time on the ball, kind of their influence is slightly lessened. Second, I think there's an issue with squad size in general. I think big clubs hoard too many players, and I think, you know, back in the relatively old days, when you could only name 16 players in your squad and 14 players could play a part, it was a lot harder to keep a lot of highly paid professionals kind of happy and on board. I think those players would be more inclined to go to lesser teams. I think now you've got a matchday squad of 20, 16 who can play a part. I think it's easier for clubs to hoard players who maybe could drop down the league and be just contributing a bit more to football in general. Third issue is tactical fouling, which I think is a really big issue in the game. We actually saw an example of this in the Tottenham or Chelsea Tottenham game we were just talking about, where was it Reece James basically rugby tackled, who was it, Son? No.
Yeah, it was Son. Yeah, he was scampering clear.
That's it.
Well, not scampering clear. He was about to lead a very dangerous looking counterattack.
Yeah, and that is Tottenham's game plan. Tottenham's game plan is kind of sucking the opponents in and playing past them quickly on the break. If you want to call it a break. I know Conte doesn't really like it if you call it a break, but those situations, and I think teams playing against that are now more able to tactically foul and say, well, we can just sub him because we've got five subs, so that's not a huge issue. And finally, just, I think there's a balance in football between how much the managers are in control of stuff and how much it's a bit of a kind of, you know, runaway train they're not in control of. And I think sometimes there's an argument that actually managers can change too much now and have too much influence on the game. So, and I think there's a balance to be found. So, yeah, overall, I'm not a fan. I don't think it's disastrous for the game, but I can't really see the arguments for it. I think that's my main issue. I know player burnout and injuries and those kind of things. But as I've said previously, I'm slightly unconvinced by the injury argument when the impact of more subs is going to mean a higher tempo and it's going to mean players who have to play 90 minutes are more likely to be up against players who are completely fresh. I'm just not really sure that's going to have the desired impact, but we shall see.
The tempo and the intensity thing interests me as well, because it's something which I thought is, yeah, two sides of the coin, that you can higher rotation within the game could either mean a greater spectacle because you do still have that higher intensity, potentially less fatigue, so it's going to be a bit more played at breakneck speed, or would it become a worse spectacle because in theory you could have up to 10 new players come on the pitch and the rhythm of the game is completely disrupted, and you can almost, I think there's been occasions before where, you know, teams have made, maybe in the Champions League, have made a lot of substitutions, and beyond maybe 70 minutes you can almost write off the final 20 minutes of the game because it hasn't been kind of true to the tactical patterns of the other 70 minutes. So I'm sure it'll change game to game, but it could be, you know, I think two sides of the coin where it's even better as a spectacle because of the tempo, or even worse because the rhythm of the game is just absolutely disrupted.
So much to unpack with this that I don't really know where to start. And I already feel like trying to find answers, or at least trying to present answers, is a bit of a fool's errand here. I mean, for a start, Mark, you know, you wrote a piece ahead of the new season about the five subs rules. You dug into data from the European leagues that have used this, and you tried to work out things like, does it favour the bigger sides? And how does it impact injuries and burnout, etc.? It struck me that it's so difficult to do your job on this front. It's so difficult, specifically with this conversation, to measure impact and to find correlation, given that there's so many factors that go into the result of a football match. There's so many factors that go into a goal being scored in a football match. And therefore, to measure the impact of an individual substitute or the extra two, as it may be, outside of did they score the winning goal, it's just impossible, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you've hit it spot on there in terms of the impact. And that's why I looked at the correlations and relationships between these things. And notoriously, correlation is not causation. So you can't actually then look at the actual causation itself. So that's why I mainly looked at it like that. But you're right, there's so many things to unpick. And I know that, yeah, we won't labour the point about the top sides. But I think one of the arguments I made was that more substitutions doesn't have a relationship with more league points. And that just makes complete sense anyway, because it's not necessarily about the quantity of players that are changed within the game. It's all about the quality of players. So if you're a better side anyway, you're more likely to get more points, irrespective of whether you make a lot of substitutions or not. So naturally you'd think that would follow, that this is not going to have too much of a relationship. But I mean, on the note of burnout as well, in the piece I wrote that Liverpool and Chelsea both played 63 games in all competitions last season. And Aston Villa, as a random example in the Premier League, played 41 games in all competitions. So 22 more games from Liverpool and Chelsea. So that does lend itself to the burnout idea. And I know that you got to think about rotation between games as much as within games. But if there's, you know, talking about players in the red zone and injuries come into play, you do think that maybe there is a case for it when you look at that stark contrast of two teams in the same league, but 22 games separate them in terms of all competition games played.
It definitely seems to make sense to me, someone with absolutely no knowledge of sports science, that rotation between games would have a bigger impact than a manager being able to take two extra players off. Partly because, and this is purely anecdotal, so far, Michael, what I think I've seen from the five subs rules is that the fourth and fifth sub, the extra ones, are mostly being taken off in the last 10 minutes of the game, if not the last 5 minutes of the game. And it's hard for me to understand how that would make a ginormous impact on the physical fatigue and or the recovery ability of a player that's played 86 minutes rather than 93 minutes.
I think you're right. I don't have anything more to add. I agree.
Good. Well, I just wanted to bring up something off the back of one of your points, Michael, about tactical fouling and about being happy for a player to take a yellow card to stop an attack because we can just sub him off. Basketball had an issue with this, and it was kind of funny in a way, but it made a bit of a mockery of the sport for a while. The phenomenon was called Hacker Shaq, and that's because Shaquille O'Neal, who was an incredibly dominant, very large basketball player who made the game look very easy and was almost impossible to defend against, he was terrible at shooting free throws, which is what you're allowed to do when you're fouled as a basketball player. You get a free shot at the basket, and some players convert 90-95% of them, and some of the players convert 50 or 40% of them. So it became a tactic of coaches to bring on a reserve player, a bench player, purely to foul Shaquille O'Neal, because the idea was he had less chance of scoring points with free throws, like a free shot, a goal, than he did in general play, receiving the ball near to the basket and just dunking over folk. So they would bring on a scrub, for want of a better word, just to pick up five fouls. I think you're allowed six until you have to come out of the game. And it didn't just happen for O'Neal either. It's happened more in recent times as well. It made, to my eyes anyway, it made a bit of a mockery of the sporting integrity of that game. And it was, to my eyes, terrible to watch. An extreme example, I guess, Michael, of what you're kind of suggesting could be increasing in our sport, football.
In our sport, yeah. I think...
That was so soon, that's... Oh, my God.
But, yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, that's the issue with tactical fouling, that the compensation for the attacking of the team with the ball is just nowhere near what they've lost. You know, that's Spurs' game plan. That's what they're trying to achieve. They're trying to achieve those good chances breaking into space. And if you just get a free kick in your own half, the opposition have 11 men behind the ball, yeah, it completely changes the game, doesn't it?
So which Premier League managers are enjoying this longer leash? Because that's the other thing. A lot of managers have asked for it, but you know, you've got to walk the walk after you've asked for five subs. Which managers have actually used their five subs across both games so far?
Yeah, I was surprised to see just three sides, again, just two games played, but only three sides who have used five subs in both of the games. And it's Manchester City, Manchester United and Brentford, which I think is interesting for different reasons, which we can come on to. But for Manchester City particularly, I think it's quite interesting because looking at last season, again, in this piece that I did about substitutions, Pep Guardiola actually averaged the fewest substitutions made per game across the whole league last season. So averaged just 2.1 substitutions per game, you know, across the whole campaign. So interesting to see that he's used five so far. But I think, as you say, I looked into it and three of those substitutions against West Ham were after the 88th minute. So it's not necessary to change the game as we'd expect, but maybe to just give players more minutes and young players more minutes, which I think we can come on to. I think that's an interesting point there.
You can look at it two ways. You can look at it just in terms of the number of changes, or you can kind of do what you briefly referred to, Ali, in terms of when they actually use them. I mean, Newcastle, for example, have used eight subs of their 10 on offer so far, but the subs have only got an average of 7 minutes per appearance. For Fulham, it's actually even fewer. It's 6 minutes per appearance. So, yeah, there's it's interesting. It's a good point you make that a lot of the subs are clearly coming very late on.
And I guess while the transfer window is still open, there's a chance that managers will use, or rather not use, subs in order to send a message to the board, Michael, that they need more signings. This squad isn't deep enough, and here's the evidence.
Yeah, maybe. People love this kind of conspiracy theories going a little bit too far with what I'm calling it. But it does, I mean, it is interesting. Leicester, who haven't made a single signing, have lost a couple of key players, might lose a couple more. Brendan Rodgers has only used four subs so far, and of course has named an unchanged side. So maybe he's sending a message, or maybe that is literally just all he's got to work with.
Famously good at sending messages either in an envelope or with his substitutes. I just want to shout out a manager in the EFL, in League One, Peterborough United's manager, Grant McCann, who on opening day, they were 2-0 down to Cheltenham, made a triple sub at half-time, which I guess is nothing new. That's always been an option for managers in the modern game. But previously, you weren't then able to make any more. He did make more. They won 3-2. That worked. And then last weekend, they were losing to Plymouth Argyle, and Grant McCann made what might be the first ever quad sub at half-time. 4-on, 40% of his outfield players came off. He made the change. Didn't work, still lost the game. It's a really interesting discussion. I think it's probably one we could come back to later on in the season with a larger sample for Mark to work with. I want to talk more about things like the flow of the game and whether it has an impact. You know, do we see? Well, let me ask you now, Michael. Do you think we see, with more substitutes, fresh attacking players bringing fresh impetus to the game, or you sometimes see the argument, well, actually, subs need a bit of time to get going. So sometimes it can take away some momentum from the game.
I can see both arguments. I think at times, you can just see a side is loading up on attacking players. I must say, sometimes when you get so many substitutions in such a short period of time, maybe it's just
confirmation bias.
Yeah, maybe it's confirmation bias, but it just feels like sometimes the game has just become a bit scrappy, almost like international friendlies do when there's loads of subs. I can't work out whether that is right or not, but I have to think about that more, to be honest. It's a good question.
And as someone who's interested in youth development, you know, that argument that more young players may get more minutes here is something that I guess initially I sort of think, oh yeah, that would be good. And the more I think about it, the more cynically I think that probably won't happen to a hugely important degree, but I think we'll need to wait a few more months until we actually could work that out with some data. So let's move on to another change, which we were told about just before the start of the season. That was to do with refereeing. Always a hot topic, isn't it? Refereeing. Yeah, referees have a higher threshold this season for physical contact. So in theory, anyway, fewer fouls, fewer free kicks being given for little tugs or a little bump here and there. Michael, have we seen this the first 2 weeks of the season? Can you see it?
I must admit, I'm a little bit perplexed by all this, because people were saying exactly the same thing last season. They were talking about this higher threshold for fouls, and I didn't really notice it then, I must be honest. And I haven't massively noticed it this time around either. So I don't know about all this.
Mark?
I mean, I wonder how much it will change throughout the season as well. I'm trying to think of an analogy, almost like a teacher telling a pupil to do something, and they do it for like a few minutes just to show that they've listened, and then things sort of taper off a little bit. I don't know whether it's almost what the referees are doing, as they're told, and then come the end of the season, it'll all just be back to normal and they'll be their strict selves. But I think I've seen it a few times. I think in the Liverpool Crystal Palace game, there's a few times where I thought that looks to my eyes to be a foul that should be blown up for. But it did create a bit of a more of a flow to the game. But then I think it naturally led to it being a bit more like for like. So when there was one foul that was let go, then when the next foul was within the same sequence of play was a foul, you think, well, you let the other one go, so now you got to let this one go. And then players are becoming more irate, and then it might build up to kind of a potentially bigger foul, if that makes sense, rather than a lot of little cynical ones. So I don't know. I'll be interested to see how the pattern works out across the season.
Would it be wrong to say that's exactly what we want to
see?
Yeah,
I think so.
You know, but yeah, I think I've seen this across the Premier League. Some of the games I've watched this season, that first Premier League game was at Arsenal Palace. I thought it felt like we were seeing it. But again, there's every chance this is confirmation bias because it's been talked about, so you just notice it more. I also just think it's quite a funny one because in general, I think, yes, that's great. I think we'd all love to see a game flow a bit more and fewer fouls being given. When it happens against your team, it is very difficult to swallow. There's been a few, certainly in the Championship, where attacking players have gone up for aerial duels with centre-backs and just smashed into them. And the ref's been like, well, high threshold this year, so tough luck, centre-back. That guy's got no intention of playing the ball, but I'm just going to let this play for the sake of it, which I think probably isn't a good thing overall, but means more goals. Anything in the numbers, early doors, Mark? Fewer fouls this season?
I don't think, again, there's too much in the way of sample size to go from, but there's so far there's been 9.9 fouls per team per game. Which compared to last season, it was across the whole season, 10.1 fouls per team per game. So really not really anything in it, to be perfectly honest. So again, it'd be interesting to see how that plays out across the season. But again, it might be confirmation bias from my perspective where I'm seeing a few occasions where the game's been let go. But in the numbers, nothing too much to report home about.
But there's also like a bit of a contradiction about this thing because no one wants fouls in games, do they? I mean, if you say, Do you want a game with loads of fouls or not many fouls? Most people say they don't want many fouls. They want the game to flow. But if there is a higher threshold and that sets the standard, then eventually you end up with a game where there is like loads of physical contact. Mm. And it just becomes a bit of a kind of, you know, a bit scrappy and a bit too physical. So the fouls per game thing can be two things. It can be the referees being stricter so there's more fouls, or the players being dirtier. So there's more fouls. Do you see what I mean? It's almost like a bit of a contradiction in a way.
I wonder how much PG Moll thought this through. We'll see. One of the equally upsetting things about the modern game on this sort of note is time-wasting game management, call it what you will, particularly from teams who are trying to see the game out either for a win or a draw. It's incredibly annoying. It's another thing, a bit like tactical fouling, that feels sort of... it's not really what we're all there to enjoy. Does it feel like any progress has been made in reducing this in any way, Michael?
I know people are kind of very worried about the kind of ball in play time now. I did see some stats the other day where the average in the Premier League is about 58 minutes or something like that. I don't think it's a massive issue overall. I must say, I think this basically has always been the case. I think what can be the issue, which you kind of allude to, is the ball and play time can be massively different from one game to the next because of time wasting. So yeah, hopefully they do clamp down on it a bit. I was kind of had an idea the other day that maybe every goalkeeper should just start the game on a booking because, I mean, goalkeepers get booked for time wasting, but it never actually, I mean... Have you ever seen a goalkeeper dismissed for two bookable offences? Don't think I have. And I can't imagine many goalkeepers miss a game through suspension because of five bookings. So actually booking, it kind of hurries them up after that. But they always get booked in like the 82nd minute or something, don't they? You need to do it in the 20th minute and then you might scare them into action. Or just give them a booking from the start.
Yeah, that happened with Vincent Goita on Monday, didn't it? He got a yellow card in like the 90th minute because he was taking ages and just carried on. And you think, well, he's not going to get the other yellow card. So he's fine to just have that one as a free hit. But again, it might be confirmation bias. But I think Reece James got a yellow card against Everton in the first game for time wasting. So those are two examples that I can think of. So I don't know whether there has been a little bit more clamping down in terms of giving yellow cards or maybe it's just those are the two examples I can think of in my head.
And then this sort of thing leads me to have thoughts that I'd rather not have. Like, if my team is trying to see a game out and the goalie doesn't get booked for time wasting, that's, you know, he hasn't done his job properly. Do you know what I mean? It's all a bit ridiculous. What I'd like to see happen semi-seriously, or at least trialed, maybe in one of the lesser leagues, so to speak, would be that as a punishment for time wasting, and this is not my original idea, but I've co-signed it, would be to give a corner to the opposition instead of a yellow card for the goalkeeper. Much more damaging, as you've said, much more likely to hurt the team. And I just think in the Premier League, we've got a referee, we've got all the other officials, we've got a ton of people sitting in Stockley Park. We've got loads of clever robots and AI now, don't we? We've got it all. I don't see how it would be that difficult to start a timer when a goalkeeper either catches the ball and has a goal kick to take out of his hands, or from a certain moment, a couple of seconds after the ball has gone out of play for a goal kick, and say, you know what, if you take more than 10 seconds, I mean, there is meant to be a rule out of the hands anyway, which is clearly doesn't get enforced at all. But let's say from a goal kick, if you take more than 10 seconds before you run up and kick the ball, corner.
I like it.
They could just buzz the ref's watch like they do for goal line tech. I mean, I can't see any flaws in this plan. I know that Michael, if he had an issue with that, he'd be coming straight with both barrels. So the fact that he's sitting there nodding, that gives me great confidence.
Yeah, I don't hate it. And I think there is almost a logical argument that if you've got a goal kick and you don't take it in time, it's almost like a foul goal kick. And so it's a corner. The same way if you don't throw a ball in properly, it's a foul throw, it goes the other way. So I think there is kind of some logic there. Yeah.
Finish with a couple of quick hits. Manchester United, trying to cut through some of the noise, Michael, I just wanted to ask you a pretty simple tactical question based on their defeats to Brighton and Brentford. What have been their biggest issues on the pitch so far? And can we see things getting better with time, which is what often happens with a new manager coming in? Or is there something inherently broken here?
I think the worrying thing is they've been quite different defeats in a way. I think really Brighton were very successful outnumbering them in terms of the midfield and playing through them very easily. And Brentford were very successful at pressing high up the pitch. So they've been, I'm not sure there's necessarily a blueprint between those two games. I think they've been just very different. So I think they've got a few issues. I must say it's not necessarily a tactical thing, but I think the situation with Ronaldo is kind of the worst of both worlds. I think ideally Ten Hag would have moved him on. If not, have him stay at the club and knuckle down and train hard. But it seems like they've ended up with an unhappy player who's still at the club, and I think that's going to undermine Ten Hag's authority. But yeah, at the moment it's looking a bit of a mess. Nothing went right against Brentford. I mean, to be 4-0 down at half time to Brentford, with all due respect, I mean, that's one of the most shocking results I can remember in the Premier League.
You spat out the word Brentford there, like Sir Alex Ferguson saying Japan. Back
yeah,
in the days.
Yeah, that's a good shout. I mean, in a way, I thought Brentford and Brighton were, they're almost the two type of games you don't want first up, because if you just lose to a big club, it's kind of like, well, those things can happen. But Brighton and Brentford, whilst both very good sides, still have the reputation as being like, well, a few years ago, they were in the fourth tier or whatever. So for Manchester United to lose to both of them, it does feel quite damning.
Was that maybe the difference last season with Arsenal? I know that they did lose to Brentford in the first game, but it was Manchester City and Chelsea, I think, were the other two games. So it was sort of like, well, at least they've got those games maybe out of the way and they can go up from there. But yeah, it was a strange one. I think the playing out from the back is kind of key in all this as well, because it's such a closed moment where you can obviously set up from an attacking perspective, and from the opponents, you can really see what United are looking to do in a moment in time, rather than it being obviously fluid within the game. So the ease in which Brentford just managed to stop United even playing out from the back, and the execution of it, I think, was the key thing, because the cards are on the table a little bit now. That we know how Erik ten Hag wants United to build out from the back. Those cards are on the table. And it doesn't seem like they've got the skill or the confidence, whatever it might be, to actually go and execute it. So for anyone playing United in the next few weeks, it hopefully would be, or you'd imagine it would be, just rinse and repeat in terms of trying to stop them from playing out the back, because they looked so, so poor that you've got a blueprint now to try and attack them, or at least stop them building out.
They started against Brighton without a recognised striker. They started against Brentford with Cristiano Ronaldo up front. Two clubs towards the top of the Premier League who did go out and get nines this summer, Darwin Nunez and Erling Haaland. Michael, what have you made of these two additions to the Premier League and their start to life?
Well, the Haaland thing is very interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, he barely touched the ball at the weekend. I think his first involvement was getting the assist for Gundogan. In the first game, he played, I think, pretty well. Obviously, he scored both goals. His runs into the channel prompted both goals. But again, he wasn't overwhelmingly involved. I think he's clearly a different option for City, and he is going to improve the way that they play. I'm interested to see what happens in big games, because I think it's those games where Guardiola has often tried to play or wanted to play without a proper centre forward. And I don't know whether Haaland can play a different role. I don't know whether he can be used out wide. I would say probably not. I don't know whether he's at the status where he's almost undroppable for those big games. So I think that'd be interesting. And Liverpool, I mean, probably not much more needs to be said about Darwin Nunez. But I mean, after a decent impact as a sub in the first game, I mean, the way he got, what do you even call it? Bullied by Anderson?
Rattled
by Anderson? Yeah. I mean, the amazing thing is it's not completely uncommon for this kind of thing to happen for a foreign player coming into English football. But I just think he's Uruguayan. Mm. I mean, of all the kind of major footballing nationalities, which I think Uruguay absolutely is one, considering their history and how good they've been over the last 10 years, you know, you think of Suarez, you think of Diego Godin, you think of Arevalo Rios. Like, it's a football culture that's about kind of being bitty and niggly and difficult to play against.
Streetwise.
Yeah. And how he got so constantly rattled by Anderson. I mean, it was a masterclass of centre-back play from a player who I don't really think of as being along those lines. I think of him as quite, you know, quite silky, quite, you know, intelligent with the way that he defends and very good with the ball at his feet. But yeah, it was almost like he was playing against Claudio Gentile or something. It was remarkable.
I feel like Anderson's been a bit of a standout player of the first 2 weeks of the Premier League season, because both of Palace's games have been televised, and against Arsenal, a lot of people were noting the quality of his long-range passing in particular, and against Liverpool had another big impact on the game and for an entirely different set of skills. Lastly, Michael, the top goal-scoring human in the Premier League, has 3 goals. Own goals has 7 through 2 weeks. That's a bit of fun.
Yeah, we've seen a remarkable number of own goals. We've also seen some other just weird trajectories. I think at least 3 goals off the top of my head have gone in via deflections. There's been 2 goals I can think of where a defender has played the ball against a striker's boot and it's just flown into the goal. There's been some other, obviously, comedy goals. The second goal Brentford scored against Manchester United, just really a daft error. There's been some calamitous moments. It's been great to see.
Brilliant. 2 weeks of Premier League football, plenty of topics to discuss on the Tactics Pod this week. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. Always feel free to let us know what you enjoyed, what you didn't enjoy, anything you'd like to take on from what we've discussed, extrapolate further with your own thoughts. Do get in touch. You can comment on the Athletic site, on the podcast section, on this podcast episode specifically. Of course, you can get in touch with us on Twitter as well. Make sure you're reading everything on site at the moment, particularly Michael's piece from this morning. If you're not a subscriber, well, theathletic.co.uk/tactics is the place to go to become one. Michael's written a piece about the Bundesliga and about Bayern Munich. I'm not going to give anything else away other than to read one comment which says, "Michael, you have way too much time on your hands, it seems. This is silly." I always think that's a pretty good reflection of some of Cox's best work. So head to The Athletic to read that today. Big thank you to Mark and to Michael for joining me. And I reckon we'll probably go again next week, won't we, on The Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a 1-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.